Thanksgiving 2018 is history. Time to restart the fruitcake mystery. And in 3 short weeks, hearts will beat stronger as we turn towards spring and the days get longer. Welcome to Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. This week, the tale of two orchestras, each with their own interpretations of familiar music, all in one big concert. Jeff Peterson from the Jazz Orchestra, Nobu Yasuda from the Symphony Orchestra, here today. 200 Main, the gallery in downtown Eau Claire, features women writers beginning next Wednesday. The gallery's Jo Ellen Burke and first guest writer Kathy Salton stop by. Jim Oliver is here with both What's on Stage generally and What's on Stage in Shell Lake. His guest is Roger Sweeney, directing A Nice Family Christmas for the Theater in the Woods. And I do believe this is our point of initiation. 50 years of anything is noteworthy, and when it's 5 decades of running a radio station, it gets downright impressive, especially when getting it going in the first place was a struggle. Congratulations to WRFW, from which WPR programs, including Spectrum West, emanate in the college town of River Falls, Wisconsin. Dr. Lauren Robinson was there at the beginning, 1968, and he's here today. Take us back to 1968. Tell us about the moment of conception. Was it on a back burner for quite a while, or did it pop into someone's head and then quickly became something you had to do, or how did a college radio station in River Falls begin?
Well, the story is convoluted and complex, as most things are, it seems, when you're dealing with universities. There was an interest in the mid-60s to put a station on the air. That was part of a growing movement at that time. Universities were starting to put in their own, what they called then, educational or non-commercial radio stations. The rationale for those was to provide some kind of additional outreach, you know, from the university to its community, and also provide some services for students on the campus as well. So there was an effort made in the mid-60s to get one started. It failed. And it did so because the individual who was behind the effort came in with a budget far too high for the university's taste, and also wasn't able to find a good location on campus for the station. He left, went away kind of, I guess, angry or upset, perhaps about his lack of success in getting a station started, and I replaced him, and I came in 1967, and they gave me the charge to try again, and so my first year I taught and advised the student newspaper and also worked on putting the station together. And I had a plan, a theory. The main roadblock, of course, was cost. So
my thought was
to make it a bare-bones beginning and come in with a low-ball estimate and use primarily used equipment. So my budget estimate for building the station in total, including renovation of space, was $9,000.
Wow.
Ludicrous, of course, even then, back in the earlier days.
Where did you find the used equipment?
We just chopped around. It wasn't hard to find. We found our transmitter in Chicago, a 10-year-old unit, and we found our antenna at the same place. Mm-hmm. I drove down in a university station wagon and broke the rear springs, getting them up to the campus. So the market for used gear was then and now relatively healthy. The other problem we had was finding a location for the station, and that took some creativity. I looked high and low, and I found that in the basement of North Hall, which is the university's main administration building, there was a basketball gymnasium before the university's major athletic complex was built, and there was still some space to shoehorn in a radio station. So we took that location and built the station actually on the old basketball floor, lines still in place.
Yeah, I have a line here in my notes that says you were first located somewhere between half court and the free throw line.
I'm not sure exactly where we were, but I'll tell you one thing, the acoustics certainly weren't very good, yeah. As you can well imagine, being on a hard surface floor like that.
But that's the other thing I was going to bring
up. Yeah, so for $9,000, we put the station together. We couldn't afford to hire any help to get the FCC license. So we did it ourselves, and it was rather complicated. The typical course of action, of course, was to hire a lawyer and and engineering help to do that, and we didn't have the money for that, so we were able to make that effort and get that done on our own. Actually, we only failed on our first attempt. We got it done second time around, and our first attempt failed because we weren't able to check carefully into other call signs. We had picked a call sign that was in use, and that was back before, of course, the internet. We couldn't search for other call signs to check out whether ours was unique or not, so sure. We took a chance, and it was not. We had picked WFSP, an abbreviation of the university's slogan, "Where the Free Spirit Prevails." Beautiful name for a station.
Oh, wow.
But it was taken already, so we had to go to Plan B, and Plan B ended up WRFW, and that was approved. So that was a major roadblock we had getting our license, was simply to get the right name on the station.
I'm just jotting down here, "Where Free Spirit Prevails." I don't think I've heard about that. Is that still in use?
It may be older.
I don't know.
Yeah, it is. I don't know whether they're still using it, but they were at that time, and it made a nice name for a radio station, certainly.
Let me remind our listeners, we're talking with Dr. Lauren Robinson, founder, first faculty manager, WRFW in River Falls, on the campus of UW-River Falls. They, this month, and we don't have much left of this month, and that's why we wanted to get this conversation in, are celebrating 50 years of broadcasting. You had quite a party, too, didn't you? First part of the month, you had a good turnout.
Yes, we did. It's amazing how many alumni of the station are out there. We put a Facebook page online early in the year to try to round up alumni we didn't have information about or didn't have locations for, and we currently have 350 alums active on that website, on that Facebook page. You can imagine over 50 years for a university radio station how many students would have come and gone during that period as staff members, and so we must have had 500 or more staff members over the years, mm-hmm. and many of them have maintained an interest in and maintained some contact with the station, and we found a lot more to add to the list to help us celebrate the 50th birthday.
Now, one of the news releases that I read said that at the time, back then, you believed, quote, "Once the station proved its value to the university and community, you could make necessary improvements," unquote. How long did that take?
Not long, actually. I knew that starting out we had to go lowball because, again, of the concerns about money. But my theory has always been if something is good, just get it started any way you can, and then you can just hopefully make it a success, make it valuable, make it worthwhile. And we were able to do that. And by the mid-70s, we were treated to a move to the third floor of North Hall, large and well-equipped and beautifully renovated studio facilities with new equipment. We also, around that time, moved our transmitter and antenna northwest of town with our own transmitter site, and so we boosted our power then and went stereo, and by the mid-70s, late-70s, we were a pretty well-equipped operating station.
You have already alluded, been in your current location since 1976, but, hey, it's getting a facelift.
Right. As a birthday present, I think, for the station, the university, I came through with a complete renovation of the current facilities,
wow.
Updating, modernizing. It's really amazing, as you can imagine now, when you look at photographs of the early station and compare it with today, it's like horse and buggy and Star Wars. It's just so totally different as we've moved through all these various stages of technology as radio has grown up. So the new station is absolutely beautiful. Not only is it well-equipped, but it just knocks your eyes out the way they put together this beautiful, very modern facility. And we're very thankful to the university for its continued support of the station.
I love having the experience that allows me to tell stories about the early days, my early days. It almost seems Conestoga wagon-like to some people, you know.
Yeah.
They can't believe the hardships that we had to put up with, cutting and taping reels of tape. And
you bet.
That was our way of editing. Cartridge machines, we had no effects whatsoever. One of my favorite stories is doing a commercial once in a bathroom because it had an echo in it. You know, and so I don't have the story of, walking 3 miles to school in a blizzard, so this gives me some credibility.
Well, there's some pretty funny stories about the station in its early years. We were spinning vinyl, of course, as you know, and all the rest.
You bet.
And gradually, as things came along that made things simpler, we were able to adopt those. But one of the funniest stories about the early station and its location was that we were under, of course, the first floor of North Hall, and our main studio was right beneath the woman's lavatory. And when the microphone was on and somebody upstairs flushed, the listeners were treated to a very recognizable whoosh.
Wow. I can't say I've ever had that in my career.
We had a lot of stuff like that going on, of course, in the early years. And the station really got off to a very good start. We were committed to not just rock and roll for the student audience, but we were serving campus and community. The station resided administratively in the journalism department, and so we used it as a broadcasting laboratory for our broadcast news students and did an awful lot of news coverage and public affairs coverage on campus and in the area as part of the station's commitment. Also, we were, from day one, heavily involved in broadcasting home and away university athletics, primarily football, basketball, and hockey, and that's continued to this day. One of the great successes of the station, I think, is its success in helping students who wanted to go into broadcasting careers get a leg up, get started. And we've had so many students go off and do great things in broadcasting. I couldn't even begin to list two Emmy Award-winning students, alums out there, and we've had students go to the National Network in New York and work out of there. We've had sports broadcasting and a lot into administration, some radio station, TV station managers, to consulting, national consulting firms. And all over the Twin Cities area, we have young people who have finished recently. It's been just delightful to see the station serve in that capacity, a laboratory for students to get into broadcasting if they wanted to go that route.
You can't learn radio in a book, I always say.
That's exactly right. Absolutely.
And we're very happy to say, as a final note, that you've been affiliated with Wisconsin Public Radio for 20 years.
And we're happy to be so. We are located out in the western reaches of the state. The network was having a hard time getting into some of the far western areas, and I think the use of our station in part to do that has been a wonderful win-win.
Well, Lauren, it's been a pleasure talking to you. You're a wealth of information, and I, in wishing WRFW a happy 50th birthday, have to include you in that, the guy that got it started.
So, I was the guy, yeah.
So the happy birthday goes to you as well.
Well, thanks, Al. Pleasure to be with you. I really enjoyed having the talk.
And all the best to those who made it happen, those who make it happen, and those who will make it happen tomorrow. We're proud to be partners. Visit WRFW887.com. Online. This is Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Art Z Gallery in Amory. November features Mixed Media by Jan Killian, Acrylics and Watercolors by Cheryl Manwiller, and Bee Jewelry by Joanne Horisberger. More at artzgallery.org. Support also comes from Marquardt Toyota with the all-wheel drive RAV4, an SUV committed to reliability. Marquardt Toyota, located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or marquardttoyota.com. Support also comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona, presenting multiple exhibitions annually, while home to art inspired by water, including Washington Crossing the Delaware by artist Emmanuel Leitze, mmam.org. Coming up, the Battle of the Orchestras and a gallery with amenities, but before he turns the spotlight on a specific theater production, here's Jim Oliver with what's on stage all over Western Wisconsin this holiday season.
Miracle on 34th Street, a production of the Festival Theater of St. Croix Falls, will play through December 24th at the Franklin Square Black Box Theater. A Christmas Carol will be staged by the Menominee Theater Guild Friday through Sunday and December 7th through the 9th in the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. Sorry Wrong Chimney will be staged Fridays and Saturdays beginning Friday and continuing through January the 6th at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The River Falls Community Theater will present the best Christmas pageant ever Friday and Saturday, and next Friday and Saturday in the Unitarian Society in River Falls. A Little House Christmas will be staged by the Eau Claire Children's Theater December 7th and 8th, and the 14th through the 16th in the Oxford Theater. The Northern Star Theater of Rice Lake will present A Charlie Brown Christmas December 7th through the 9th, and the 14th through the 16th. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will present Closed for the Holidays December 6th through the 9th and the 13th through the 16th at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. The Phipps Children's Theater will perform Bah Humbug, Scrooge's Christmas Carol, Fridays and Saturdays, beginning this Friday and continuing through December 16th in the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. And the Red Barn Theater of Rice Lake has announced its schedule for 2019. The season will include Church Basement Ladies, the musical, Lone Star Spirits, Mamma Mia, the musical, Lost in Yonkers, and A Gentleman and a Scoundrel. Auditions for the season will be held on January the 12th at University of Wisconsin, Barron County.
There you go. And Shell Lake is where he's headed this week. It's all yours. Back to you, Mr. Oliver.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. Phil Olson has written 15 published plays that have had more than 350 productions around the world. Some of his plays include A Nice Family Christmas, and then there's A Nice Family Gathering, Mom's Gift, and the Don't Hug Me series of musicals written with his brother Paul Olson, and also Polyester the Musical. Theater in the Woods of Shell Lake is opening A Nice Family Christmas on Friday and continuing Saturday and Sunday, and the following Thursday through Sunday in the Erica Kwan Memorial Theater. Joining us by telephone is the director, Roger Sweeney. Thanks so much for taking some time to talk to us today.
Thank you, Jim, for having us on.
I looked around for some reviews of the show, and the Los Angeles Post-Examiner reviewer said, from the first opening lines to the surprising, joyous conclusion, the entire audience was almost in constant laughter. So I gather it's a comedy.
It's a comedy, yes. Yeah, and there are parts of it that are downright hilarious.
It's a Christmas play, but I guess we're supposed to drop the kids off at the neighbors when we go. It is not recommended for children, I guess.
Yeah, and some of the thought that went into that, Jim, was that, you know, there's a lot of program stuff that's available for kids and younger people that's around. And there's usually not a whole lot of stuff for the more mature audience, but we didn't have any trouble as far as leaning toward this production and putting a note out there that it was really for adult audiences.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of language. It's not really all that bad, but there's a bunch of innuendo and some other stuff. The grandmother is really a scandalous character, and some of the stuff that she does and says would probably be going over the kids' heads.
Tell us what the play is about.
Well, it's a get-together with the mother, the grandmother. There are three kids. One of the kids is married. He's a doctor, and his wife joins in the production also. And then there's the uncle, the brother to the mother, whose husband has passed. And he's a little bit of a tipsy character. He comes in. He's already been drinking a little bit and celebrating. But he has his own moments of recovery also.
Tell us who the cast members are.
Okay, we've got the cast of seven. We have Pat Shepherd, who's playing the grandmother, and then Kathy Brin, who's playing the mother. And both of those have been in a number of plays together and also plays that I've directed. I often do a Christmas production up here, and they've been stalwart performers. Del Bauckham is a retired dentist, and he's playing the uncle. And then we have the kids. Troy Benham, Dan Hubert, and Kalani Baumgart. They're the three children, and they represent a very successful doctor, the older son, Michael. And then there's the middle one, Carl, who's an aspiring writer. And then there's the youngest girl, Stacy. They all have their own little struggles and problems. There's been a little bit of estrangement between them. The doctor... son is a little bit on the high and mighty side. The middle son, he's struggling. He's trying to outlive his older brother as far as the shadow that the other brother is constantly sitting over on him. The younger girl, the daughter Stacy, we find out that she is gay and she has had a baby. So there's the struggle that goes on between them as far as working toward an acceptance of one another. And then the grandmother is in there, and she's trying to figure out how to accept any and all of them, for that matter. The mother is constantly a pacifier. She's constantly trying to smooth things over and make everything nice and Christmassy. And lo and behold, we find out as we get into the play a little further that... Mom has been diagnosed with breast cancer, and this comes as news to the whole family. So then we proceed through the rest of the play and discover that pretty much the bottom line is that through some open and honest communication with one another. We can very often sort out our problems and our difficulties, and we get to a happy ending.
Well, that's nice to know. You said a little bit about the process of selecting this play in the first place.
As I say, I've done a number of Christmas productions, and every year I find myself trying to find out, okay, what are the publishers out there presenting now for Christmas productions? And I order up a bunch of scripts, maybe a dozen or a dozen and a half some cases, find out that I can go through them real fast and that they are just not anything of interest that, you know, I want to do or have a part of. But now and then I come across a little gem, and I think that Phil Olson's play here, A Nice Family Christmas, is one of those, and decided, okay, let's give this a whirl, and especially with that role of that grandmother and what she does in this play, it was like, this is going to be a hoot.
We are talking to Roger Sweeney, who is the director of the Theater in the Woods production of A Nice Family Christmas. We talked about the cast, we talked about the play. What about the technical side of the show? Is this a fairly simple set, or is it complicated, or what have you got there?
Yeah, this is really a remarkably simple one. We do have the three walls and the doorways and everything, and then some of the set pieces in place. The lighting is pretty much a constant. There is a telephone call at one time as far as sound effects, but that's about it. It's pretty simple in that respect. The whole focus of the play really is on the cast and what they're doing on that set.
Do you have any trouble getting people to come and build sets for you? Or do you do it by yourself?
That's a mixed can of worms here, Jim.
Yeah,
There are often, we've got a few people that are real stalwart as far as being there. John Cook is just phenomenal as far as his availability throughout the years and his support for the theater. We have a new guy coming on, Kent Syke, who just crossed paths with him a few weeks ago, who is getting actively involved, and he's helped us tremendously with building the set here. He's been helping out with the prompting, working as an assistant really for the director here, and he's learning some of the new lighting type stuff that we're going to be employing also. So, yeah, there are some people out there. The director always wishes that there was a lot more of them and that they were more readily available, but well, it's community theater. People do have lives, and we try to keep together as best we can and meet everyone's needs. The director just kind of tries not to let it show.
Well, it's always been my experience with community theater is that the most successful ones are the ones who have the volunteers who come and are willing to build sets and to tear down sets when the show is over and do all of the grunt work that's necessary. And that's all they really want to do. It's a great social event. You go out and rub shoulders with some nice people, and it's a lot of fun. And every now and then, one of those nail pounders will graduate onto the stage. And so it's always an interesting process to get people to come and work on the tech crew. Tell us a little bit about your experience in directing and acting. You said something about you've done other Christmas shows.
Well, actually, it's been scattered over a lot of years. When I was in college, I did a little bit of acting as far as the theater program they had at the college. And that's going back to the 60s now, Jim, so that'll give you an idea about what my age must be. Then I was teaching for a number of years, and I got involved in some local community theaters as far as doing acting. And then when I got out here at Wisconsin, I got involved in the group up here in Spooner, mostly acting. But then after a couple of years, I decided, I think I might like to try directing. And so I found Agatha Christie's, and then there was none, and I was just totally charmed with the possibilities of that play, and that was my first directing job. I loved it. I think it was a very successful project. And after that, did intermittent acting in some plays, and then also directing. Most of my directing has been winter productions around the Christmas season.
Well, the play is A Nice Family Christmas. It was written by Phil Olson. The Theater in the Woods production opens Friday and continues through Sunday, and then runs the following Thursday through Sunday in the Erica Quam Theater in Shell Lake. We've been talking to the director, Roger Sweeney. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Jim, thank you for having us on.
It's 2018. You'd think we could get a good phone line, thankfully 90% of them are. And thank you, Jim. Theater in the Woods website is TITW.org. Down the road on Spectrum West, Symphony and Jazz, two orchestras on one stage. Well, on today's show, as you know, we talked about the little radio station that could. There's also a gallery in Eau Claire that might also fit that description of determination. It's called 200 Main. Artist and entrepreneur Joellen Burke has been there throughout, and as it grows in stature, it stages new events, one of which is hosting women writers. The first chapter next week features author Kathy Sultan. Both Joellen and Kathy paid us a visit. Now, Joe, I used to feel sorry for you guys, torn up streets in every direction, but it appears the respite from normal activity and watching roads being altered allowed you the time to ponder your own road. The 200 Main Gallery, now 200 Main Art and Wine, has grown from an awkward little duckling into a gracious swan in the relatively short time that I've known her. I guess the gallery is a true testament to the old adage, you have to walk before you run. Let's retrace the history and end up where you are today.
Well, with that poetic intro, Al, wonderfully complimentary to the gallery, starting a couple years ago, I guess we were fledglings and finding our way as a gallery in the location that we truly loved on the corner of Main and Graham. Mm-hmm. It's evolved in a way that we feel encompasses downtown. It embraces the arts. We're carrying on with over 30 artists that we're representing. Mm-hmm. In the course of that time, as you mentioned, we had a street construction entailing months.
Yes,
and it tested our patience. But the timing of that coincided with our examining just what we want to do to promote the arts in our small world. And establishing the idea of combining art and wine, we felt would bring a little better number of people in. I think galleries in general, art galleries, can become a little intimidating or off-putting to people that aren't sure exactly what to do as they enter a gallery or even enter thinking they're required to purchase something every time. So we really want to create an inviting atmosphere that is really appealing to everybody, and all are welcome, as we say, to join us. As we look at different art, we're trying to embrace now, as we've gotten through that segment of the road construction, and now that we have a liquor license, we're trying to carry on with our 30-some artists as well as writers, as Kathy can share. Then we're also doing some wine tasting classes. Terry Meyer, my partner, will be doing some painting. Wow. He does watercolor, and he'll be sharing some demonstrations. And then we incorporate music in the area in the forms of Robin Mink we've had, Julie Makowski. So we hope to do more of that and create a lively atmosphere for celebrating the arts.
The way I've put it in my notes, give people a little wine and who knows what they'll come up with.
Well, it does. It does enhance environments. We're certainly, as we worked to get this liquor license, we made sure that people didn't make some assumption that we're a tavern, as the stereotypical sound of it. So we're really an engaging atmosphere that focuses on the arts and tries to create a comfortable setting. And I think wine entices that as well.
Yes, it sure does. You alluded to it, and you've hit on it, an idea to engage women writers, one of whom is with us. Tell us what's about to begin, and then we'll get into details.
Well, we have a vibrant writing community that we're really proud of. We felt that it might be really appropriate to celebrate the women writers in our area on the first Wednesdays of every month. And having met Kathy Sultan and knowing Kathy's reputation and her quality of writing and her great books, including her recent novel, it was a natural choice to ask if she would be willing to join us on our first Wednesday of December 5th.
Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you, Al.
You live in Eau Claire, but what you write about is a very long way from where we are and maybe what we think we know about the Middle East. Is it that fact we think we know from watching the news but really don't that inspired what is now a series of books on the topic in the region?
Indeed it is. I had the opportunity 49-plus years ago to walk into another world, and I took that first step and never looked back. And I think that having lived in Beirut itself for 15 years, eight of which were under the bombs during the Civil War, We return very frequently because we still have family there. My husband's Lebanese, so it's his family who still live there.
Okay.
It's given me the opportunity not only to renew our friendships of 15 years, but to avail myself of the opportunity of becoming what I call myself an eyewitness expert on what goes on in the Middle East. I've also done some NGO work in Israel-Palestine for over 10 years,
mm-hmm.
and I think I have a pretty broad idea of maybe they're my own interpretations, others would differ, but nonetheless, I do have some expertise in that field as well. And after writing 3 books of nonfiction, I accepted the challenge of my editor who said, why don't we do something different? And so I thought, at 70 plus, what should I do? I said, why don't I put my expertise to the test, see if I can write a novel? And that's where the origins of The Syrian, which is my first novel, began.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first of 3. It's a trilogy. Recent release was The Damascus Street, the second of the trilogy. And I decided, one, it's more fun to be writing fiction. I don't have to worry about footnotes.
Sure.
I've enjoyed it. I've been able to put my life experiences, people I've met, situations I've been in, whether it's the war zone or being near a politician who got blown up
mm-hmm.
in Beirut, and I've been able to put those experiences into fiction. And I think more importantly, as you alluded to, we don't really know a lot about the Middle East. It's a very complicated, complex place. And I think what I like to do, and I think I've succeeded in doing, is telling a good story in these 2 instances, spy thrillers, and throwing in a lot of information that I think enhances our readers' knowledge about what really does mm-hmm. go on there.
That's the voice of Kathy Sultan. She's an author and a writer. Her latest work, Damascus Street, is going to be discussed at what is coming up at 200 Main Art and Wine on Wednesday, December 5th from 5 to 7 p.m. And the co-proprietor of 200 Main is with us as well, Jo Ellen Burke. I chimed in because if you talk too much, then people aren't going to have to come to this, and then they won't. So on the 5th, what are guests there going to experience in your presentation? Are you going to talk like we've been talking, or are you going to read some stuff? What are you going to do?
I think what we just spoke about is a good intro. I might shorten it up a bit, but I think it would be fun to talk about how you put together a spy thriller.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to reading excerpts from the book. I might do a little bit of that. I'm part of the book festival, okay. And over the years, we've never had a spy thriller writer, so I think it would be fun to just introduce the community to something different.
I have a feeling you're also going to have to field some curious questions
from people about
what it was like to live there.
I love doing that, Al, very much.
All right, Joe, talk about 200 Main. You've already given us the history. Now let's talk about the future. You have some things in your hip pocket. What are you thinking about?
We are always thinking, and there's so many exciting, inspirational ideas. We do want to cover as many forms of art as possible. Writers, such as Kathy, carry on the desire to inspire and inform, enlighten, and we are really looking forward to that. Whether it's in visual arts or music, theater, writing, that's what we try to reach for within what we're going to do in the confines of our space.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll carry on with events and the women writers. Patty C. will join us on January 2nd. February 6th, we'll have Molly Patterson, and we're hoping to finalize Jan Carroll on March 6th.
And you know what? I think we should probably mention that the Women Writers on Wednesday is very affordable.
It's actually free.
Ah.
We do have limited seating, so we ask that people sign up, 200main.org.
And Kathy, where can we get your books?
You can get them locally at the local store
and
on Amazon. Mm-hmm. I'll have a few books that night as well to sell if people are interested.
Can people find out more about you and your books online?
KathySultan.com.
S-U-L-T-A-N.
T-A-N.
And Kathy with a C. Thank you, ladies. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Al.
Title is 200 Main Art and Wine, but if you're a beer guy like me, you're in luck. It's not in the name, but it's in the fridge. They have that too. Spectrum West on WPR and support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Art Z Gallery in Amory. November features mixed media by Jan Killian, acrylics and watercolors by Cheryl Manwiller, and bead jewelry by Joanne Horisberger. More at artzgallery.org. Support also comes from Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona with Craig Blacklock's photos exploring the St. Croix and Namekagon River, celebrating the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. More at mmam.org. Two orchestras in our neighborhood have the same first name, Chippewa Valley. Their surnames are also the same, Orchestra. But it's the middle names that are distinct. One is symphony, the other is jazz. Sometimes, and the holiday season is a good one of those sometimes, they share a stage and offer their own interpretations of classic music, well-known music. Whereas the stage might have been cramped in the past, now they enjoy the expansive Pablo Center RCU Theater stage. And they'll share it Friday evening, December 7th, and Saturday afternoon, December 8th. It's called Let's Go Nuts, Cracker. Jeff Peterson represents the jazz collaborative. Nobu Yasuda speaks for the symphonic collection. And my first curiosity was how that all began. Whose idea was this?
The first time?
Yeah.
I think the first time we did it, Mark Blasky was your executive director there.
Right.
And I was having dinner with Mark, and we were talking about it. Because we had just done a concert with the Youth Symphony, where we had done some back and forth. And we thought, you know, it would be really fun if we could do this with the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. And I think that's where it started. That's a long time ago.
I also felt it was a very great, actually, project. Because, you know, maybe the jazz orchestra would play the Ellington version, and we just play the original version. But there never be a kind of exchange of, you know, we play the original and they actually play the jazz version after that. That's a really interesting project, right?
And I think it makes a great contrast. I mean, you get to see what Tchaikovsky did, and then you get to see how Duke Ellington heard it and what he decided he could do with it. And in some cases, it's pretty literal. In some cases, you can hear exactly where Ellington's going. And in other cases, you're like, I wonder what made him think of that. That's a really interesting spin on this particular, I mean, like the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, the Ellington version is very different. You know, it's very kind of sultry and gritty. It doesn't sound like a fairy at all. It's got much more of a... Huh.
Well, there are different kinds of fairies, just so you know. I mean, there are slow fairies and fast fairies and light fairies and heavy fairies.
Okay.
So I could see how he would see it differently. So how tough is it to get jazzy big band arrangements of classical, cool, holiday-oriented music?
Well, actually, it's surprising how much classical music gets arranged for big bands. Benny Goodman used to do Moonlight Serenade, right, is a classic version. You get a lot of this stuff that was done, especially in the 40s and 50s, when big band composers were looking for some new material and they were trying to sort of expand their repertoire. Guys like Stan Kenton and Woody Herman did it as well. So there was this sort of explosion of this stuff in the 40s, actually really all the way through the 60s. And people are still doing it.
Yeah.
You know, the arrangement we're doing of the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth was just done a decade ago. I mean, classical music is a great place to look for this sort of material.
So do you follow previous arrangements, or do you sometimes do original adaptations for your group?
Well, in this case, we actually have one original arrangement.
You do?
We are doing first movement of Mozart's 40th symphony.
Wow.
A former UWEC student, Andrew Neasley, who's also coming back for our February show, just did within the last few weeks an arrangement of that movement for us and set it as a Latin tune. So we'll have a little bit of a mambo, a little bit of a salsa in there. In this case, we've got, truly original arrangements.
Part of this whole concert concept to me feels like a sitcom. It's like the symphony is the straight guy, and then you come in with the punchline.
Yeah, actually, I'm very, very curious about, like, you see, Beethoven, you know, Fifth Symphony, as you know, it's a serious stuff. You know, the Beethoven said, thus my fate knocks at the door.
Yeah.
So we present this serious music, and I'm really curious how they're going to cook, put on the table.
Oh, you don't know?
I don't know. And then also Mozart's Symphony No. 40. This is also serious stuff. But it's rather kind of dark.
Yes.
I don't know what kind of damage they're going to make, but I mean, I'm very curious.
You know, now here, this is a question that I had actually slotted for towards the end of the conversation, but since you brought this up, knowing what you know, as much as you know about all these wonderful classic composers, what do you think they would think people doing this to their music?
The thing is, actually, particularly Mozart, I think he would be like, wow, this is amazing. If Mozart were still alive now, he would be a jazz musician, I'm sure. He and also Johann Sebastian Bach.
You could have him in
the
group.
Guest artist.
Interesting.
Yeah, sure, right? I mean, they would be thrilled to hear that. I don't know about Beethoven. I mean, he just went his own way. I mean,
he might not be able to hear it anyway.
No, yeah, I know that was a thing, right? But Mozart, definitely, if he heard that jazz version, he'll be really on the piano. He keep going improvising, I'm sure.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know, but I think.
So how is the concert formatted? The symphony plays the original, and then you guys tear it all to shreds, or do you guys tear it all to shreds?
That seems a little harsh.
I'm saying beautiful shreds.
Oh, okay.
Is there a number on which you both play back and forth? Is there a little bit of each?
No, we'll trade off. So, yeah, the symphony will play the original so the audience can hear that, and then we'll play the jazz interpretation of it, except for the very last tune, because the symphony traditionally ends with Sleigh Ride. We'll do that one together with a little variation.
Having fun in the studio with Jeff Peterson from the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra and Nobu Yasuda, Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. Let's Go Nutcracker is Friday, December 7th, 7:30 p.m., Saturday, December 8th. What time?
2 p.m.
2 p.m. I guess it's that good. It has to have two of them. Let's make sure that we bring up your special music director for this show.
Yeah, Bruce Herring, who was actually the original musical director of the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra when we first started back in 2009, 2010, is coming back just to do this show, in part because he was the musical director when we did this collaboration the first time, but also because he is, I think, unquestionably one of the great Ellington experts in, you know, the region. And so having someone who really understands Duke Ellington's music as an abiding passion for it, is something you need, because I mean, like any good symphonic work, Ellington's work has an enormous amount of subtlety and complexity, and having, you know, Bruce back, because, you know, he understands and has spent so much time researching Ellington, I think it's a wonderful thing. So we're absolutely excited to have Bruce come back.
He's a good guy. Glad he's coming back. I think Jeff should be made to direct the symphony and vice versa.
and Nobu should play drums?
Yeah. It would be fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can make it up something.
Some year in the future, I think.
In the future? Okay.
I mean, you guys talk about trading roles. Let's really trade roles.
Okay.
So now, Nobu, you brought up Mozart, and I'm curious whether your music education, because you are highly educated in the craft, did your music education include only classical? I mean, you're a violinist, or were you able to let it all hang out once in a while? Did you ever get into jazz?
Actually, my education itself did not really include any jazz or anything like that. Yeah. However, though, I always liked to listen to jazz, and then actually a few times I tried to, you know, learn jazz, and I asked my students, you know, because we have a wonderful Jazz One students actually at the university. I actually asked for, you know, kind of a help. Okay, how can I, you know, improvise? They're like, oh, sitting at the piano. Okay, I'm gonna play some chords and just play whatever the notes. And I started playing whatever the notes. And the student said, well, that note doesn't include, I mean, it's not part of this chord. But you said it's any notes. I'm just doing that. It's not that easy, actually.
No.
You just need to actually understand that their vocabulary, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there is a certain kind of a vocabulary. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, you know, if I spend a little more time, I'm getting, I think I can learn it. But I'm like, this is so hard. I just kind of gave up on that.
How does it turn out at the end? Do people in the symphony and people in the jazz orchestra, because of this collaboration, do they end up having this wonderful appreciation for what each does?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I remember last time actually we had this one, so it's like basically 9 years ago. So, at the dress rehearsal, you know, at the concert we already know what they do, but at the dress rehearsal, we don't know what they're going to do. I mean, the jazz musicians know the original, right? But, the symphony people, they don't know what kind of a, you know, jazz version. So then we were like, wow, this is amazing. I mean, so we were really stunned. And I mean, Yeah, I'm sure that, you know, this collaboration is going to, we'll end up probably some musicians talk to each other. And so if they have some kind of opportunity to, you know, do some performances. Yeah, that's why it's very important that actually we collaborate like this. We have a lot of wonderful community musicians.
Yes. So what actually is on the playbill? What are you going to be performing? Do you have a brochure? We have to remember.
Okay. So the first half of the show is going to be Hungarian Dance Number 5. Mm-hmm. Hall of the Mountain King from Edvard Grieg.
We're going to give people a little taste of the differences that can be made with that tune.
Yeah, the first movement of Beethoven's 5th,
right,
and the first movement of Mozart's 40th. And then the second half is all selections from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker and then Ellington's versions thereof. And we're not doing the whole thing because the whole Nutcracker is all by itself quite long. Right. And then if you throw in all the Ellington versions, we'd all be there until about midnight. But but we're doing 5 movements, I think, from the Nutcracker.
Right, 5.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to thank you guys for coming in, and I was going to end it by saying have fun, but I don't think I have to say that because I know you're going to.
Yeah, obviously.
Oh, yes. This is going to be an incredibly enjoyable show. It was great fun the first time we did it, and I think it'll be even more fun this time.
Yep. So are you thinking about new wrinkles? Does it have new wrinkles every year? Have you been able to expound on things? I think the conducting thing is good for next year, but what are you going to do?
You mean in the future? Or you mean different?
Yeah, for future concerts. Do you build on things?
I hope so.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we just need to get together and have more ideas. And there is more work being done. There are more composers now who are writing for example, full big bands and symphonies at the same time, not just pop versions, but real legitimate music than there has ever been. I actually know half a dozen composers who are actively doing work like that. And so I think there's definitely a point somewhere in the future where it doesn't have to be a holiday show anymore.
Right.
It can be, here's new music that really involves all of us playing, not opposite each other, but all together. And I think that has the potential to be incredibly cool.
Yeah, I think this is very important because, you know, usually when we, you know, perform as a symphony, just the jazz fan, they go to their concert, but they might not come to, you know, symphony concert.
Sure, sure, sure.
However, this time, both, you know, audience will come and they learn. Both fascinating. And also, you know, symphonic music actually, why is lots of symphonic music actually become a source of lots of arrangement or inspiration of the jazz musicians? Because it's a melody or harmony, what it is, it's very inspiring. And as a classical musicians, sometimes we repeat the same notes, right? I mean, the thing is, I try not to do that because that's why I study scores. I try to get myself excited about the jazz musicians, jazz composers kind of make incredible arrangements. Like Beethoven, 5th Symphony. Can you imagine? I mean, because da-da-da-da, that's it. But somehow, taking this music to some kind of incredible journey, I'm so excited about hearing that.
How about the appearance of the groups? Is the symphony going to be starchy and tuxedos and you guys?
Well, I'm assuming the symphony will be wearing their tuxedos.
Right, we do.
The CVJO has had a long tradition of a sort of black on black. We may spice it up with some exciting holiday-themed bow ties. But beyond that, we're not going too far overboard because, frankly, we want people to pay attention to the music. We want them to hear.
I think,
you know, if we all get, you know, ties with LED lights or something like that, then we're just distracting people.
See, what you just said is proof that I should not be involved in this because I was going to bring up ties with lights on it. It's good that you guys don't do that. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
There you go. CVSO, CVJO. Now, I put together a couple, actually 4 total, 30-second clips, music clips, examples of the contrast. Now, Jeff brought up Hall of the Mountain King. Here is the classical version. And this is what jazz can do to it. one more set. This is the first movement, the March, from the Nutcracker. And the March from the Nutcracker with a facelift. Wow. The concert, Let's Go Nuts Crackers, Friday, December 7th, 7:30 p.m., Saturday the 8th, 2 p.m., Pablo Center, RCU Theater, online, pablocenter.org for tickets. Thanks, Jeff and Nobu, for an enjoyable conversation. Got some Spectrum memos for you. The Big River Radio Wave performs the annual Best Christmas Show Ever Sunday at the Big River Theater in Alma, featuring Grammy-winning songwriter Bill Miller, comedian Mary Mack, poet Max Garland, and author B.J. Hollers, plus the unmistakable music of String Ties. Shows are at 5 and 7 p.m., recorded for Wisconsin Public Radio broadcast on Christmas Eve Day and Christmas Day. BigRiverTheater.com is the website for tickets. At the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls, Saturday evening, The Dark Side of the Yule, Christmas Meets Classic Rock, 7:30. Sunday, it's the North Winds British Brass Band at 2 p.m. Next Thursday, December 6th, that's the Christmas Craft Fair beginning at 10 a.m., featuring the Holiday Tea at 2 p.m., and a Christmas sing-along at 6:30 p.m. CVCA.net. The 40-member FIPS Festival Chorus presents An American Christmas, Immigrant Roots, Saturday evening, 7:30, and Sunday, 2 p.m. at the FIPS in Hudson. The Hot Flashes return to the Wide Spot in Stockholm, Saturday evening at 7. The Red Cedar Choir's holiday concerts are Sunday at 2 and 4 p.m. at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Rice Lake. Thanks to Rachel, living up to the doctor's prediction, oh, the places you'll go. Appreciation also to Kate and Dean for their reinforcement. Thanks don't do justice for Jim Oliver's contributions, but I'll use it anyway. And for you, the people for whom we do this, well, that says it all, I guess. See you next week.